Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Protests have been ravaging the streets in the towns and cities of Mozambique for 2 months following a disputed election result. We'll hear from one protester on why he's not about to back down.
There is a song here in Mozambique. It's from a revolutionary singer who died. It's called Azagaya. He said that I'm not afraid anymore of being killed because this regime has killed me many years ago. So this is the feeling that I have now, that I've been killed long ago.
Also, South Africa and Nigeria, two of the largest African economies, haven't always been at good terms with one another. Why is that, and how are they trying to resolve their disputes economically, politically, and socially? It's Thursday, the 12th of December. First, to matters concerning Ethiopia and Somalia. In a deal that's being described as a breakthrough, Somalia and Ethiopia have said they would now work together to resolve a dispute over Ethiopia's plan to build a port in the breakaway region of Somaliland. The two countries say they will find commercial arrangements to allow landlocked Ethiopia reliable, secure, and sustainable access to and from the sea. This all came about following talks on Wednesday mediated by Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan. Now, the initial agreement between Somaliland and Ethiopia had threatened to destabilize the Horn of Africa. Why? Because Somalia sees Somaliland as its territory and had accused Ethiopia of meddling in its internal affairs. So what did Somalis think of the Ethiopia-Somaliland deal?
It brings instability, but I think it will be more than 1 decade or 2 decades to build a port in Somaliland.
Ethiopia building a port in Somaliland cannot happen without the approval of the Somali federal government, as it would be considered illegal in Somali internal affairs. Ethiopia, as a neighboring country, should respect Somalis' integrity and the stability of the region.
The views of Somalis. Our correspondent in Addis Ababa, Kalkidan Yibeltal, told us what Ethiopians thought of their government's plans. Let's listen.
A lot of people seem to be very much interested in the idea of Ethiopia having this maritime deal, or even the general possibility of the country gaining access, a direct access to port or even naval base. So the idea by itself seems to be something that would make a lot of people happy, something that would be welcomed by a lot of the general public in Ethiopia, happy because the country is the world's most populous landlocked nation. And since the early 1990s, it has not had its own port, does not have its own coastline. So any sort of change that will amend that or that would create an improvement in that regard is going to make a lot of people happy here.
Now, at a news conference at the recently held talks, President Erdogan welcomed the agreement.
With the valuable contribution of both countries, we have created a joint declaration text that we have agreed on today. The joint declaration focuses on the future, not the past, and records the principles that these two friendly countries will build on from now on. I congratulate both my brothers for reaching to this historical reconciliation with devotion and thank them for their constructive attitude.
To get some analysis on this news, I spoke to regular Focus contributor Dr. Hassan Kanenje. He is the director of the Horn International Institute for Strategic Studies in Nairobi. What's his reaction and how significant is this?
I think yesterday's development was particularly significant considering the tensions that have been going on between Mogadishu and Addis Ababa. And it underscores, I think, the importance of diplomacy in that within this agreement, it's going to ensure access that is reliable for Ethiopia as the most populous country in the region. But it's also going to ensure that access is going to be done under the federal government of Somalia, which solves the million-dollar question that has been going on with regard to whether that is ever going to be a possibility for a rapprochement between those two countries. Now, that in consequence has implications with regard to collaboration especially in the wake of the expected departure of the ATMIS forces from Somalia, which had created a very uncertain and complicated situation. But I think with this agreement, there is a lot more hope, not just with regard to what is going to happen in Somalia this coming year, but generally in reducing the general tensions within the Horn of Africa region.
So the tensions may cool down, like you're explaining, but there's still, you know, differences. Somalia will still be concerned about Ethiopia's push for access to the sea. I know the agreement says they'll find a way to make sure that can happen in a manner that makes everybody comfortable. So will this fundamental issue still remain, even though they have basically agreed that, you know, everyone can cool down, let's find a way around this?
Like any conflict situation, there has to be a starting point. Now, the starting point was having an agreement to resolve the problem. But what is critical to any agreement, to this agreement, is setting up a framework and timelines within which a number of contentious issues need to be resolved. Now, they schedule alternatively to start no later than February and to be completed, you know, within 4 months. So that's extremely helpful because then it sets timelines within those issues can be resolved. Now, like in any interstate relations, there's still going to be continuing, you know, questions with regard to the nature and extent of that arrangement, which in the agreement, it says that those issues will be resolved through dialogue. And I think the regional organizations, as well as the African Union and the international community, probably they may be seized with that idea and ride on that express, you know, demonstration of willingness to pursue diplomatic channels to urge both parties to stick, you know, to those agreements, despite, of course, what may come, you know, this coming year.
Okay, so it's just talks at this moment that, you know, will happen beginning not later than February, like you said, and to conclude within 4 months. But in the meantime, what's going to be happening on the ground? Does it mean that Ethiopia will now pause its MOU with Somaliland?
I think by implication, then that is expected to happen, because if it doesn't, then Somalia will not be obligated, I think, to go by the agreement, and perhaps it may reignite the tensions we've seen this past 1 year.
So the agreement signed between Somaliland and Ethiopia is a statement of intent. Why has it been so controversial?
It's been so controversial in part because in political terms, it infringes on Somalia's sovereignty. But at the same time, there was not good relations between Mogadishu and Addis Ababa that could actually allow for negotiations to even take place. And so the absence of leadership and the willingness of the, you know, appropriate leaderships to pursue that path, of course, has contributed to the intractability of this problem, you know, in the last, you know, 10, 11 months. But I think with the entry of Turkey that has interests and relationships with both Addis Ababa and Mogadishu, there has been a mediator that perhaps who is trusted by both, you know, Addis Ababa and Mogadishu. And I think that has gone a long way in resolving the current stalemate.
Yeah. Talk to us a bit about that trust, because one might wonder how Turkey was able to get these two presidents, these two countries, to sit down and initially agree that they can have a conversation around this.
Turkey, as an emerging and resurgent power within the Horn, has worked in the last few years to establish strong relations with both Mogadishu as well as Addis Ababa. And so it's no surprise that both of them will be willing to be mediated by Turkey, as opposed to other perhaps external powers or even other Middle Eastern powers who may be partisan in their approaches to not just to the issue, but also to the relations they have with both countries.
So I'll take you back slightly to that deal then with Somaliland and between Somaliland and Ethiopia. Why does Ethiopia really want that deal? And what would a new arrangement look like? Because they do want, yes, access to the sea. They are the most populous, landlocked country in the world. It's important they feel that they have access to the sea. Why is this so important to them? And what would these talks bring in terms of an access?
Because I think as the largest landlocked country, I think, on the continent, it is important for them to know that they have a guarantee when it comes to access to the sea. And it's not just going to be dependent on the whims or a given leader for a given country at a given time. It's a country that has been struggling with sea access for a while right now, and that has caused trouble, and not even just with the, you know, Ethiopia or with Somalia, but even previously with Eritrea. And sometimes they've had their own tensions with Djibouti, which, you know, whose ports, you know, 90% of its business actually comes from Addis Ababa. And so, yeah, I think they're keen to ensure that they can get some guarantees with regard to access to the sea that will not be disrupted.
So what does this all say about Turkey's influence then?
Turkey's influence in the Horn of Africa region has been increasing, not just in the Horn of Africa, across the continent. It's demonstrated and deployed, extensive soft power in doing so. And at the time when, for instance, the Western partners are distracted with the conflict in Ukraine, you know, Turkey has not only built friendships within the continent, but has is increasingly playing both a developmental security as well as diplomatic role, as evidenced by the current agreement between Mogadishu and Addis Ababa.
Tell me if this deal could still unravel, because a Somaliland opposition leader, Abdirahman Mohamed Abdullahi, who had been very critical of the deal with Ethiopia, is due to be inaugurated this Thursday.
Well, I think the determinants of the deal are going to be the main players. And if Addis Ababa thinks it's going to be prudent to deal with Mogadishu, then it doesn't really matter much what Hargeisa, you know, may be inclined to think or to want. Because Addis Ababa was a big brother in that, you know, arrangement. And it's one that, you know, of course, was sought to have that access. So if that access can be ensured by Mogadishu, then I really do not think, you know, it's going to be of much consequence. Of course, it may create some discomfort, you know, within Hargeisa. But when you look up from it from geopolitical, you know, perspective, remember the federal government of Somalia is still the only one that is recognized. Hargeisa has been trying to get recognition for its independence, but not with much success. And that doesn't mean they do not have legitimate concerns or grievances, you know, to claim, you know, statehood or to want to be independent. But I think to the extent that they seem to be a formalization of engagement between federal government of Somalia and Addis Ababa, it's going to leave a little room for Ethiopia to robustly, in any meaningful way, deal unilaterally with Somaliland.
Dr. Hassan Kanenje, Director of the Horn International Institute for Strategic Studies. It's been over 2 months after Mozambique went to the polls, and the country has been rocked by violence since. Protesters soon came out to demonstrate against the result of the October 9th election that saw the ruling Frelimo Party candidate Daniel Chapo win with over 70% of the votes. It's an outcome that opposition candidate Venancio Mondlane and his supporters disagree with. And despite civil society groups estimating that at least 110 people have been killed in the clashes, demonstrations continue. These are the sounds from the streets of Maputo in the last week. The capital has nearly ground to a halt as a result. And not only that, violent individuals and groups have been taking advantage of the fragile security situation. They have been building roadblocks and extorting money from people. You might think that all this would put some people off going to the streets in protest, but many are still adamant that they will continue. One of them is Colin Shaka, who's been telling me about his experience over the last 2 months.
I started demonstrating on 24th of October, trying to demonstrate against the lie that had been told by the Electoral Commission. We were called up by the opposition leader, Venancio Mondlane, to go out and protest. The first day I went out, it was all good, all okay. We were carrying out posters and banners, and we were whistling and chanting national anthem and African anthem. So it was all good. But things started to change when we went to the second day. We found the police, and the police was there, and they wanted to stop the demonstrations there using real bullets and gas. So the clashes started there. And since now, I've been going to demonstrations till now.
So in recent days, there's been a fresh wave of the protests. Just bring us up to speed with what's been happening now.
Well, what I would say is that in the beginning, it was a pacific demonstrations. People were out just trying to say that they are tired of the regime and they wanted things to change. They wanted the electoral truth. It was all okay. But now the conflict has evolved. Now we are experiencing clashes between the population and the police. Now, if I would say what is happening now in Mozambique, this would be the image of Mozambique right now. No cars on the streets, people whistling and chanting. Venancio Mondlane, which is the leader of the opposition, roads are blocked, barricades have been put up. And in some neighborhoods, people took the streets to put chairs on a table and have meals, read books, and hug each other and chant national anthems and African anthems and saying that the government of the day must go out.
It's a situation that has gotten pretty deadly and dangerous, especially in Maputo, with civil society groups reporting that at least 100 people have been killed in these protests. How have you been managing in terms of your own personal safety while you go out to the streets?
Well, there is a song here in Mozambique. It's from a revolutionary singer who died. It's called Azagaya. He said that I'm not afraid anymore of being killed because this regime has killed me many years ago. So this is the feeling that I have now, that I've been killed young, long, long ago. The general image in Mozambique of security now for the protesters, for me, I would say that we are vulnerable. No one is safe. You go out, protest, and pray to come back home alive. So we are not afraid anymore. I'm not afraid anymore. I'm managing my days, day in, day out. I don't know what's going to happen, but I want a better future for my sons, a better future for those who are coming.
So the protests have been banned officially by the government because of the violence that has been, witnessed. Why have you not complied to that directive?
Well, it's easy to say that when a government says that it's enough, people should cancel everything and say that, no, we cannot do this because the government said that. But it is the same government that have been telling lies. So this is one of their lies also, that what we are doing is called urban terrorism. This is what they labeled. So that's why they say that we cannot protest. But we, as I would say, revolutionaries or people who want the better future for Mozambique, we are not afraid of that. We need to go out because this was the first premise that guided them to outcast, to remove the colonial power. The colonial power here in Mozambique said the same story that they are telling us now in a democracy, that protests and demonstrations are forbidden. So we are not going to comply with that because that would instate in Mozambique an autocracy.
So let me ask you this, because you've said that the police have responded with bullets and violence. In your opinion, yes, and what you've observed, are these peaceful protests by any stretch of imagination? What do you say about these reports of residences of officials that have been invaded by protesters? It does seem that some of these protesting groups may be taking this a bit too far, don't you think?
Yes, actually what is happening now is what I said. There is a mixture of demonstrations and enraged population, because what is happening now is that if you are a member of the government, you are being labeled as someone who made us suffer. I mean, like one of the protesters who were in one of the municipalities said, he said that they were destroying a house, the house of a member of the government. And they said that we are destroying because you ate our money, you destroyed us, you destroyed our future. So what is happening now is that people are pushing too far the way they are protesting. I'm considering this situation now as like this. There are some groups that are taking advantage of these situations to commit violence.
Yes, and there are also other groups of young people that have taken advantage of this to rob and extort money from people.
Yes.
That?
This is happening now, even here in my neighborhood. We don't have toll gates here in my neighborhood. But in recent days, we have up to 10 toll gates. In each of them, you must pay 10 meticals if you have a car. And if you see those who are taking advantage of this situation, you will see that people are people who are not protesting. They are not protesting. They are just there sitting with sticks and stones and waiting for an opportunity. So these situations created a situation in which the government is staying away from this situation. He's saying that, no, I have nothing to say. And some segments of the society are taking advantage of these situations. I would say like hooligans and many other people who are taking advantage of this situation and extorting people. This is happening here in Mozambique. If you want to go to the city, you have to pay almost 100 meticals, 10 meticals in each toll gate that have been created by people who are not in the demonstrations, who don't want to change the country, but they want to steal from people.
Tell me if you see any solution in the near future of this situation in your country.
Well, this is hard to respond now. Why? Hard why? Because I, as a citizen, I know that a solution is a dialogue between all those who have been involved in the political competition. The second one is to call off the elections because they were very rigged. They were not transparent. They were not fair. Even the European Union, the Catholic Association, many other observers say that these elections were the unfair ones. The government knows the solutions. The third one would be to form a transitional government in which they would prepare the country for another election, even if it is 9 months. But what is happening now is that the government is trying to show that it has strength. They don't want to hear the citizens. It seems like we are making noise. We don't have power to do anything, even to elect. Because if you steal from us our vote, you are just telling us that we can go and vote, but the ones who are going to decide are them. So this is something that has to come from the government. The government should notice that they are the solution, I would say. They are the solution. Why? They have to be more tolerant. What is happening in Mozambique now? Where do we want to go? I, as a citizen, I know where do I want my country to go. I want my country to develop. I want my country to have peace. I want my country to be, I would say, rich. But it doesn't seem like the government wants that.
Are you optimistic, though? Because the government does not see a problem with this election and the outcome of it.
Yeah, that's the problem.
What will happen if nothing changes? If the dialogue you're suggesting, the transitional period you're suggesting, the repeat of the election you're suggesting, what happens to you and the people that have thoughts similar to yours if none of these things happen? Because there's a swearing in of Mr. Chapo coming up in January.
Yes. I think dark days are coming. We are going to have a country in which one has the president, but he will not rule. And the other one is going to rule through social media platforms. This is going to be a confusion. From what I see, my point of view now is that this is going to be a mess in Mozambique because the government doesn't see a problem with the elections. And that's the problem. That's a problem. So this is a mixture of confusion, explosion, and I would say violence. You have someone who wants to rule using violence, and you have someone who wants to resist using violence as well. So I see dark days in Mozambique. I see a regime that is going to be more autocratic because if they do rule our country, this will cement a position that they are untouchable.
Thank you so much, Colin, for your time, and do keep safe.
Thank you. Have a nice day, and thank you, BBC.
That's Colin Shaka. We have offered an interview to the government of Mozambique to give their side of the story, and we are waiting for a response. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu recently visited South Africa to co-chair with President Cyril Ramaphosa their 11th Bi-National Commission, a meeting where two countries discuss shared interests. One analyst writing about this recent visit said it underscores the potential and the problems of South Africa-Nigeria relations. Peter Fabricius went on to say that the relations between these two sub-Saharan giants seem to be permanently frozen on the threshold of greatness. He added that part of the problem here is that even at the leadership level, there has often been more competition than cooperation, seemingly prompted largely by the fact that both countries are vying to be Africa's top dog. That competition trickles down to ordinary citizens in both countries, which often plays out online. The Nigerian journalist Chiamaka Okafor said President Tinubu's visit had generated little public interest at home, And when you mention South Africa in Nigeria, the first thing that comes to mind is xenophobia. So we decided to delve into an analysis of this relationship. I called up Diana Games, the CEO of Africa at Work. She's also the executive director of the South Africa Nigeria Business Chamber.
It's a long-standing relationship that has a lot of history to it. And as a result of that history, there's been a real determination over many years for the two countries to work more closely together, to become closer in terms of political, institutional, economic, and other ways. Whether it's achieved this potential is very much in doubt. I think people will say there have been moments when the presidents of the two countries have worked together for the betterment of Africa. But on the whole, I think we've seen countries just doing their own things and coming together as needed. Don't think we've really seen these two countries pulling together always when it's needed at a continental level. At a bilateral level, there have been times when things have worked really well and the potential is always hovering above this relationship. The question is how we actually really realize that potential, because I think it's fair to say the two biggest economies in sub-Saharan Africa, both pivotal states in their regions, they could do a lot more to work within the African Union and in other ways to push Africa's development. But I'm not really thinking that we're seeing very much of that.
Why is this potential not being realized?
There's very different reasons for it. People talk a lot about the two countries being competitive for different kind of seats, UN and others. I'm not sure that's really the thing. I think there's a lot of historical baggage about Nigeria helping South Africa during the liberation struggle and South Africa perhaps not being grateful enough or acknowledging it enough thereafter. And to this day, the sense that Nigerians came to South Africa and didn't feel welcome here. South Africa, after years of being sort of isolated, wasn't always that open to Africans from other countries. And these are just things that have kind of lingered over time. I think Nigeria also was the big power in Africa at the time South Africa ended apartheid. And it kind of rained a little bit on Nigeria's parade at the time. The whole world was looking at Nelson Mandela, looking at South Africa. You know, these are some of the reasons that are advanced for this situation. But I think there's other things as well. A lot depends on who the presidents are, who's in power, what their vision of this relationship is, and what they feel the benefit is. As we know, both countries have been through a lot of tough times, mostly economically, but also at times politically. And as a result, of course, countries are quite inward looking. So I think it's been a lot of distractions more than any specific kind of reason why this potential hasn't been realized. Each country grappling with its own problems, its own issues, and also seeking advantage in its own neighborhood, which is, you know, usually the first port of call for a lot of countries. And I do believe that it's quite strongly personality driven. The right people in place, building the right kind of relationship and seeing the opportunity, bringing the private sector on board, which hasn't really always been the case, and really just getting all hands on deck and everybody working together with a strong message behind it. That's not really happened. And as a result, these relationships have drifted.
So politically speaking, I can see why it has not worked, you know, personality-driven kind of relationship that you've described. But what about economically? Because these two countries, yes, among the two largest economies on the continent, they have virtually same challenges, whether it's unemployment, sometimes the cost of living, especially for Nigeria. Economically speaking, why has this not worked out?
I don't think we can really say that it hasn't worked out. I think what's clear is the relationships economically are very different. South Africa is one of the top importers of Nigerian crude oil. So that makes Nigeria very strategic to us economically. However, the trade basket is very much dominated by that crude oil. So we have very little else flowing from Nigeria to South Africa. We're not importing any amount of, you know, whether it be cashew nuts, cocoa, or agricultural products. Also bearing in mind that Nigeria's export profile is not very diversified in any case. But going the other way, there's a lot of trade going from South Africa to Nigeria and investment. Our big banks are there, Standard Bank, First Rand. There's a lot of funding of infrastructure and other projects, you know, MTN, obviously in the digital space and others. We have seen some pullback of South African companies from Nigeria, particularly in retail property and those kind of areas. But on the whole, the trade relationships are very different on each side, which does in its own way say there are different opportunities. You know, a lot of African countries generally import their needs from Western countries or from Asia. You know, I think generally the underpinning of the African Continental Free Trade Area is really for us to all look more closely in our backyards for the goods that we are importing from other parts of the world. And I think these two countries are really no different. But I would say that South Africa's relationship with Nigeria economically has been a success. The other way around, I don't think so. There's certainly a lot of scope for movement, but that also depends on what are Nigerians looking for. You know, we're not asking them to invest here just to make the numbers look good. You know, they need to have a good reason to come to South Africa. And what do we offer that's more than other countries where they could get the same thing? So there's a lot of issues there. And unfortunately, because there have been tensions between these two countries, maybe at a more political or at a people-to-people level, it's often been translated that somehow this has crept into the economic realm. I don't think that's entirely the case. I think it's just two different economies at very different stages of development with different needs and not actually that close together.
Let's just dig in a bit more on that, you know, the social relationship. Why is it then from a social perspective this tension exists, you think?
I think in South Africa, there are a lot of issues at a certain socioeconomic level at the lower sort of echelons of income brackets. There's a lot of contestation for business, for property, for jobs, all of this sort of thing. And there is an element of crime, I think, in both countries. But Nigerians, there's a lot of Nigerians who are involved in crime. And I say a lot as a percentage of the whole, it's very small. But it all plays out in a particular kind of space. What you don't get in the business areas that Sydney and I operate in, you know, we deal with professionals who have their own companies, you know, work for some of South Africa's biggest banks. You're not really seeing it at those kind of levels. So it's more of a contestation over resources and things like that that is underpinned by a mistrust of foreigners, whether those foreigners be from Zimbabwe or Nigeria or even Somalia, etc. It's not a specific Nigeria thing. But I think the narrative of Nigerians being involved in drugs and crime has actually unfortunately stuck. However many are involved in that is not clear. But that is the narrative that is most often put out there. And so unfortunately, that's what people think. And when they're threatened or when they're under pressure, they will react to those kind of perceptions of other nations. And then I think it doesn't help that we have visa restrictions between these two countries, both of whom call each other strategic to their interests. And yet, you feel if we were that strategic to each other, would we be having all these visa restrictions in place? So that doesn't really help the sense of trust. And then I think another element is we haven't had enough big corporate success stories in South Africa from Nigeria. You know, everybody in Nigeria can tell you who the five big South African companies are or were: ShopRite, Standard Bank, MTN, etc. But a lot of South Africans have never heard of the Dangote Group or Access Bank, for example, both of whom are invested in South Africa, or even Flutterwave, these new, very fast-growing digital companies, etc. So, you know, South Africans are not informed about Nigeria either. So you have this kind of breakdown, which fuels mistrust and name-calling and just the general kind of anti-sentiment. And as I said, it's not just about Nigerians, but they are certainly included. So the people-to-people relations is difficult. And I think the problem is that South Africa, when there have been flare-ups, going right back to Thabo Mbeki's day, have not really dealt with this properly and decisively, or done very much on both sides. Both countries have not done enough to really do more about informing people about other African countries, about Nigeria, about Nigeria's history. And a lot of people don't know the kind of professional Nigerians that I certainly deal with all the time, you know. So it's a complicated issue and it really needs to be addressed, but it just isn't. It just floats on.
Thanks to Diana Games, the CEO of Africa at Work. Focus on Africa was produced by Bella Hassan, Sunita Nahar, and Rob Wilson in London. Blessing Aderoba was in Lagos. Connie Sharp was the senior journalist in charge, and Francesca Dan was a technical producer. Our editors are Andrea Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. Goodbye for now.